Really happy to be chatting today with the 8th District Congressman Stephen Lynch for an update on what's been happening here in the district and also in D.C. So, Congressman, great to virtually connect with you.
It's good to be with you, Joe. Thank you so much for reaching out. And, because of the pandemic, we don't do as much in person as we would like to. So I'm glad for the opportunity. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. I do look forward to the day when we can do it in person again, as I'm sure you do as well. But in the meantime, I thought this would be a good chance to kind of let you touch base with your constituents here in Quincy and really throughout the district to bring them up to date and what is happening in your world and what you'd like folks to know about.
Oh, sure. There's no shortage of topics, both locally and nationally and globally, obviously. So we're grappling with a number of crises, I would say. As you know, we're monitoring very closely the situation in Ukraine. It does appear we had a classified briefing recently that was probably one of the most accurate but also grim classified assessments in terms of what Vladimir Putin and the 150,000 or so Russian military we're up to in terms of the expected invasion of Ukraine. So a very concerning time, a very dangerous time right now, a time where our alliances are much more important than they have been in the recent past, but also very reminiscent of the situation that we confronted prior to World War II, where at that point, an overly aggressive, militaristic Germany threatened Poland, Czechoslovakia, and others at the beginning of World War II. So I'm hopeful, but I have to be realistic about the expectations that Putin will indeed invade Ukraine. So we have to be prepared to meet our obligations under the NATO Charter, Article 5, with our partners. So I think so far, President Biden has done exactly that.
Since you started in that topic, let's talk a little bit more about it. What do you think is Vladimir Putin's end game here? What's the motivating factor behind this aggression?
Well, he's an ideologue. And so this is not about the short term. This is about playing the long game. And he has said that he would like to reassemble the Soviet Union by gobbling up individual countries. He's taken Crimea, part of Ukraine already. And there were no immediate consequences to that. There were sanctions, but I think he was willing to absorb those and to amortize those costs. He seems to be taking a bigger grab this time with respect to the entire country of Ukraine, 44 million people whose freedom would disappear under a military attack. He's also threatened Moldova and a number of other countries. So there's been an ongoing tension there. I'm concerned, especially because of the approach of NATO. We have to work with our allies and our wishes don't necessarily prevail as a country in that international institution. So it appears that NATO has taken the position that that economic sanctions will be applied if Russia were to invade. But, I've spent a fair amount of time in that part of the world, been back and forth to Ukraine many times. And Russia's attitude may be entirely happy with that in terms of, sure, we get Ukraine and you fine us, basically, with economic sanctions. And I am entirely uncomfortable with that. We have other countries like China that has always played the long game. And if we told them, we're going to put a price on Taiwan, they would pay it. They would pay it. And they would amortize those costs over the next century or so. So we have to be very careful about laying our cards on the table as NATO did. You know, it would be better, I think, to keep Russia and China guessing about what our responses would be, rather than laying our cards on the table and saying that, you know, our response will be entirely economic and with sanctions against individuals. That's a dangerous position to take. And I'm just fearful that people like Putin and Xi will take you up on that deal. And especially with countries like China, where the supply chain is based for many of these countries, it would be very difficult for them to disassociate themselves economically from China in the long term. It would cause great hardship on their own people. So you have to be careful about the positions that you take. I think there's much more to it if you consider the view from the perspective of these authoritarian states. They don't have to worry about the free press. They don't have to worry about the next election. Putin's been in for 22 years. She is recently appointed leader for life. So there's nothing to stop their military push and their desire to gobble up their neighbors and destroy their sovereignty and take away the rights of those individual people.
So do you think that the U.S. should be more militarily involved then rather than economically?
I say we should leave them guessing what we might do. Don't put your cards on the table and say we won't respond militarily if you begin to slaughter the Ukrainians. That's not good. That's not a good tactic to take, because once they realize that they don't have to worry about NATO, they don't have to worry about the U.S., there's no risk. That's what happened in Crimea. Mm. They went in and took it, and it was cost free. Mm. That's why Putin's at it again, because he paid no price that he could not bear. There were some financial sanctions that are still in place, and he just keeps doing what he's doing. So, I know it's difficult. We just came out of Afghanistan. We're still involved, in parts of Iraq and Syria. I realize that. I chair the Subcommittee on National Security, so I know what our current obligations are, and I know how unseemly that may be to many people, but. This is the world that we live in. These are dangerous times, and we need to stick by our principles. And while we don't have to declare war, we could make it clear that when a major country like Russia uses military force against a country of 44 million people, and given the fact that we do have troops in Poland, Romania, Germany, anything can happen. And so, in the fog of war, that's something that could happen. Those troops are in close proximity. And so I would just reserve my right to tell Putin that anything can happen. Very, very bad things could happen for Russia if they make this move. And I don't agree with the tactic that the NATO leadership has taken. It's not President Biden's strategy. It's the NATO strategy, and that strategy had to be taken through deliberation and cooperation with countries that are in direct proximity to Russia.
How do your colleagues in Congress feel about it, Congressman?
I'd say it's a mix.
Okay.
I'd say it's a mix. There aren't a lot of, it's sort of in my bailiwick because of my chairmanship on national security. So I've been there many times and I understand the situation probably a little bit better than most. And there are so many other concerns that we have internally. you know, obviously this country is going through a rough patch, you know, domestically. We had the attacks on the Capitol on January 6th against our government. Nothing makes Putin happier. Nothing makes our adversaries happier than seeing Americans attacking each other, attacking their government. It's a shameful, shameful, and, you know, just despicable situation. But it's what we're dealing with. So, you know, while we're trying to deal with these international crises, we're also trying to mend those wounds that occurred on January 6th and that continue in some ways today.
Can we talk a little bit about some district issues? And primarily, I know you're very involved with the compressor station in North Weymouth and the latest developments there after the FERC meeting.
Right. Well, as you know, FERC came out belatedly and issued a report that, you know, under the FERC guidelines, the siting of that compressor station should not have gone forward and that it was not in compliance. But that's after the fact, after the place is built, after it's up and running. So, you know, I filed a request to ask PHMSA and FERC, two agencies that have jurisdiction, to rescind the licensing permit to allow that plant to go forward. And my argument was that we were not given, and I'm speaking on behalf of Quincy and Weymouth and Abington and Braintree, all and beyond those other communities. Hingham is also concerned. My argument was that we were denied due process. All of those protections and the regulatory process that we engaged in. I had PHMSA and FERC come into Weymouth and do in-person hearings. We demanded that. And they went through the motions as if they were actually forcing the company, the gas company, to comply with federal regulations. But they had not. They had not. So our ability to have a say and to use those regulations to protect the safety of the families in that area were denied. And FERC admits that now. So my request was, okay, let's do this all over again. Let's pull the permit and make them go through this process again for another 8 years. And let's see where this ends up. So, you know, we're trying everything we can. We've been in court already. You know, Mayor Koch, you know, Mayor Hedlund, Mayor Kokoros, Mayor Sullivan before him, all were engaged in this and spent a fair amount of money trying to defeat this. You know, the Fall River residents against the compressor station, Frax, has been very, very active and relentless, I would say, in their opposition to this. The Weymouth City Council has been terrific. All of my colleagues, state senators, state reps, all have been terrific. So we've done everything we could. And there was a you know, an error on the part of the regulator in issuing this. So now we're trying to roll this back, but it's tough. It's tough. You know, part of the reason is that the Natural Gas Act, which passed in the 1930s, gave great power to the gas companies, because at the time they were putting these gas lines in to extremely rural areas. There were no people and there was little danger that the public would be exposed. But now, and they were also very low PSI, the pounds per square inch in these pipelines was very, very low. Oftentimes less than 5 pounds per square inch. But now they're putting high pressure gas lines in the inner cities because of the demand. And so the danger is pronounced. And yet and I've tried to get amendments to the Natural Gas Act to recognize that new reality, but I've been thwarted at every turn, mostly by my Republican colleagues who live in states that are highly dependent, like Texas, Oklahoma, that are closely tied to the gas and coal industry.
Is this an issue you think that ultimately needs to be decided by the Supreme Court?
I don't know about the Supreme Court, but certainly a federal appeals court would be able to. I don't know if the Supreme Court would take it up, yeah. But certainly that whole issue about our rights, you know, and the rights of the families of Weymouth and Quincy and Braintree and Abington, you know, those rights were denied. Everyone should have their say, right? This whole regulatory process was meant to give the rights, the due process rights to those people so that something reckless and arbitrary would not occur, given the fact that there's great danger here if they don't build a plant in compliance with those safety regulations, which has happened. So we continue the fight. You know, that's all you can do is just keep fighting. And then, you know, I've seen in other cases where we just keep fighting and eventually we win. And so I can't say when, I can't say how, but I can say that we're going to continue to fight this. And sometimes the other side just gets tired. And, you know, that's been the story of my success sometimes. You know, if you can just outlast the bastards, you know, you can prevail. So that's what we're doing.
Did you put a deadline for when you'd like to have a response to your request from FERC and PHMSA?
They have a deadline. Yeah, it's internal though. They're supposed to respond by a certain date and time. But again, so we need a rejection before we can appeal that, and so that seems to be what we're waiting for. You know, I am hoping that common sense will prevail. And that they'll realize, okay, we did foul up, we did deny them their rights, so we need to take some action. I'm hoping that dawn breaks on Marblehead, you know, that they come to that conclusion.
Okay, I know you were in the district earlier this week in Quincy here, actually, for a groundbreaking by the MBTA on a new bus maintenance facility. If you could tell us a bit about how the federal government's involved in that project.
Sure. So we recently passed a major infrastructure bill. I'm on the Transportation Committee. I'm the senior member from New England on the Transportation Committee. I serve on the pipelines and hazardous substances subcommittee, which I got on because of the situation we were dealing with the compressor station and some other areas. But one of my standalone bills was called Green Buses for Every City. It's a program. Originally it had $8 billion for electric buses so that in areas, urban areas and suburban areas, we would be able to convert from these old diesel models to clean electric or in some cases hybrid models. There are some hybrid models that use both combustion engine and also electric. So we incorporated that bill in the infrastructure bill. And so it also includes charging infrastructure and maintenance facilities for the new electric bus fleet. So partly because of my lobbying, partly because of the good work of Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Markey in the Senate, the advocacy of Governor Baker, all of us working together, Congressman Neal on the Ways and Means Committee, my colleagues, Seth Moulton and Jake Auchincloss, both who joined me later on the Transportation Committee, we lobbied to have that facility built in Quincy. And so we're on the old Lowe's site, It's actually perfect. It's got a huge area. You saw it, Joe. You were there. And so we're retrofitting that facility so that when these electric buses come online, I think 120 buses, electric buses, will be serviced and maintained through that facility. So it'll be charging, it'll be maintaining, and it'll be gradual replacement of all the diesel buses. You know, we've got elevated asthma rates in a number of our communities, in Quincy area, as well as down to Brockton, which is also in my district. So these buses will be a godsend. And it's exciting. It'll require us to retrain a lot of the workers who have been focused. You know, the machinist test is all about, combustion engine technology. Now it'll be a new and different world for many of those workers. So we'll have to bring them in, train them. But that's what it's all about, right? We want progress. The funding is there. I think it's $2.2 billion that we awarded to Massachusetts for clean energy and transference to electric vehicles, charging stations. So there's a lot there. I think the whole package was $12.5 billion. But obviously, we had to break it out for climate change resiliency, seawalls, roads and bridges, things like that. So we're working with the Quincy State House delegation, Senator Keenan, Senator Timulty, Representative Tacky Chan, Representative Bruce Ayers, obviously Speaker Mariano will have a big say in that, as well as our local delegation. I work very, very, very closely with Mayor Tom Koch. He is my partner. And I know when I get a dollar of federal funding for Tom Koch, that dollar is going to be spent wisely and efficiently. And Council President Nina Liang has been a great partner as well. So I'm blessed to be part of the Quincy delegation. And I include Mike Morrissey, the Norfolk County DA in that as well. He's been a great partner.
Any other projects in your district from that infrastructure law that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, we have some climate change resiliency needs along the coast. So we've done a small track. Seawalls are very expensive, dear Lord, but we need them, right? And so the mayor and I were down not too long ago along the water there, down by C Street, the Marymount area. Going down further. And so we have some issues with some tidal issues for that tidal basin there. But also we've got a good stretch of seawalls being constructed right now. And we're sort of planning ahead for the next few years of what we can do. But, you see these storms that, you've never seen in your lifetime. We got a report, couple of days ago about the gradual increase in sea levels in that area. So we've got to take meaningful steps to meet that challenge. And where possible, put in seawall structures, but also in other areas that you can use a mechanism to deflect or divert floodwaters into areas, marsh areas that can hold that and prevent any damage from being done to residential areas. So redirecting tide flow and things like that. So that's a challenge as well. We've got good partners at EPA and at FEMA. So and at our state agency. So and the Army Corps of Engineers, they've been terrific. So it's just a matter of figuring out which projects will be the first in line in terms of priority and get the money to them to get them started. A lot of exciting things happening. $1.2 trillion goes a long way.
I wonder if we can talk a little bit about, speaking of money, about the economy and what's going on in the country right now with inflation and the plans by the Fed to raise rates and your feeling about that.
Yeah, I'm worried about it. we had an emergency because of the pandemic. So Congress pushed money out, you know, the Payroll Protection Act, the Small Business Relief Act, the Restaurant Funding Act, extending unemployment benefits. And we got it out in a hurry. We pushed it out there in a hurry. And the good news is that we kept a lot of people in their homes. We kept a lot of businesses running to get through it. And now it looks like we're at the end of this. The problem is we pushed an awful lot of money out at a time when there was also a constriction of the supply chain because of pandemics, you know, the various COVID variants, excuse me. You know, we've had a prolonged period of lack of production, so a lack of supply. So when you have a lot of money chasing, you know, few goods or fewer goods, whether that be housing or food or gasoline, that has been constricted, the price goes up. So we've seen that. I think we will fix the supply chain issues sooner than we will fix the demand issue. And that's what the Fed is looking at. By raising the cost of money, raising interest rates, they want to take some of the energy behind the demand side of the equation. And that can be painful, obviously. It means higher rates for mortgages. It means higher borrowing costs for those who want to borrow money. So it does what it was meant to do, which is lower demand and slow the economy down a bit and get us back into a stasis of balance. That can be painful. It's not, you know, it's not a happy position to be in, but under the circumstances, you know, I'm not sure we had many good options. You know, this was an emergency. All that funding was emergency funding. But there are consequences to that. And, you know, the Fed, we're watching the Fed very closely. They seem to have come to the realization that at least 4 interest rate increases will occur in the coming year to 18 months. I'm not quite sure the increments of those increases. I imagine they would try to do that in smaller increments, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Sure. The social infrastructure legislation, Congressman, can you kind of bring us up to date on where that stands?
Well, a lot of what we did was social infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. We put a moratorium on rent increases, mm-hmm. So that, you know, people couldn't be forced out of their homes in the middle of a pandemic. We put in a freeze on firing, you know, many of these public housing developments have to be maintained regardless of whether the money's coming in on rents or not. So we pushed money out to public housing agencies to keep people in their homes. We covered healthcare costs and premiums. We suspended student loans. We pushed out, like I say, probably $2 trillion that went to address mostly the housing needs that people had. But the important part is that we preserved everyone's position. So not only did we tell the tenant that they could, you know, they didn't have to pay their rent, we told the landlord, don't worry, we'll cover your mortgage as well. And then we right up the chain. So the bank was covered, the landlord was covered, the tenant was covered. And so all of that, like I say, maintained a certain stasis. But now we're coming to the end of this and we're going to have to work all of this out. So I know part of this is state regulation. Part of it is federal regulation. And, you know, we still have a lot of work to do. We're trying right now. We try to get the social infrastructure bill through in one piece. That met opposition from some of our colleagues in the Senate, Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema. Frankly, I think there are two pieces there that are hugely important. One is the child tax credit. that actually provided enormous benefit to families raising kids, and was a huge shot in the arm. This was a, you know, this was a direct benefit to them. They were getting an extra check to sustain their households, and that's still very, very important. We're not through this yet. And the other piece was universal pre-K. So when you think about it, we were trying to, and this is still our effort, establish universal pre-K in every city and town in America, so that we could use pre-K to introduce very young children, 3-4 years of age, into a setting where they would be comfortable in a learning environment. And it would actually add a year or 2 years to the education process of all of our children. And we're in a global competition here. So think about what that would mean. Oftentimes, we find that when kids come into first grade or kindergarten, they are not ready to learn. The social aspects of being in a structured learning environment is foreign to them. They're not ready to learn. Some kids are, but many are not. And I think that causes a delay in their educational progress. So by having universal pre-K and paying teachers, you know, to take on that responsibility for those younger children, 3-4 years of age, even though, look, they won't be learning calculus or geometry, this is just basics of being together, following instructions, you know, alphabet, you know, numbers, just the very baseline of education for these children, but it will start a couple of years earlier than it would have otherwise. So we think we maximize the time, the class time for these children, so that when they do get to kindergarten, when they do get to first grade, they are ready to go. And so ready to learn. And so that's the object. And so we've worked Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin pretty hard on this. And we continue to work our Republican colleagues. It shouldn't be on the Democrats to do this alone. So we're trying to persuade our Republican colleagues as well that this is a good thing for America. And this will help us all in our global competition. So those two pieces, I think I would be willing to break those out and vote on them and get them approved in piecemeal, in chunks, as the president has said, in order to get those programs up and running. That they will be, especially the universal pre-K piece, it will require a lot of work. So if we break that out early, get the funding out there, get the teachers hired, get the facilities squared away, that'll be a great undertaking. So I think we need as much time as possible. Some of these other things can happen with the stroke of a pen, such as the tax credit. It can be renewed. Anyway, so that's my spiel on the social infrastructure bill.
Yeah, interesting. On the other end of the spectrum, do you think Social Security will remain solvent?
I do, for a number of reasons. Very tragically, you know, many of the deaths that occurred were in the aged population. I know from my own experience in my nursing homes, in my districts, I have about 800,000 people. So we saw great tragedy among many people who were Social Security recipients in that cohort. We also know that there is great agreement on the part of the Democrats and Republicans about the needs of Social Security and the need to keep that program up and running. So I think there's a general recognition that program works very, very well. And there's a commitment there to make sure that it is sustained. So I feel good about that. I don't think we're at risk. It needs work. It needs adjustment, as it always does. But, you know, the age has increased. We back years ago, they changed the protocol for being eligible for payments. That age piece has gone up and up and up, and will continue to do so. And you know, I as I said before, I think there's a willingness on the part of Congress to work together to make sure that we sustain that program.
Anything else you'd like to let folks know about right now, Congressman?
Well, I just want to say what an honor it is for me to serve. You know, the people of Quincy have been wonderful to me. You know, many of my family members have moved down there. As I've said before, they went in search of parking and they found it. And, you know, they've become part of the city of Quincy and that wonderful, wonderful community. I do want to just say what an honor it is to work with your delegation, with our delegation. You know, we've got a great group there. The city councilors are all hardworking. You know, your town officials. You know, I talked before about Mayor Koch. He's one of the, look, I have three cities. I've got 21 towns. I've got about 800,000 people that I represent. And there's nobody better than Tom Koch. You know, as a manager, as a human being, it just, like I say, when I get federal money for Quincy, I know it's going to be spent well. And at the state level, I mean, that's, you should be very proud that you've got Speaker Ron Mariano, you know, Speaker of the House. And he has been a blessing to me personally in terms of making sure that the federal money gets there. And remember, when I get federal money, there's always, I am able to finance 80% of a project or 90% of a project, like that electric bus facility. But the remaining 10% or 20%, depending on the program, has to come from the state or from the municipality in some cases, depending on the program. So I rely very heavily on Ron Mariano and you know, Senator Keenan and Tacky Chan and Bruce Ayers and Ron Mariano, especially being the speaker, to come up with that 10 or 20%. And remember, if like in the case of the Quincy electric bus facility, you know, if there's say $100 million going in there of federal money, they've got to come up with either 10 million or 20 million of state and city money. So it's, you know, I hope I've made clear that it's a partnership and that I really appreciate. And sometimes it's harder to come up with that 20 million or 10 million at the local level than it is for me to come up with the 80 million in DC because of the size of the budget. So I am grateful. I've got wonderful, wonderful partners. City Councilor Nina Liang has been wonderful. And so, you know, I feel blessed to be able to represent Quincy in the United and my entire district in the United States Congress. These are, you know, we're going through a rough patch in this country right now. But I'm hoping we can come together, not just because of the threats we face globally, Ukraine and other situations, but internally for you know, for the goodness of the people that we serve, we've got to come together, Republicans and Democrats, and really focus on the things that are right for this country, and think again in the long term about the future of our children and the kind of world we want to leave behind. So I'm thankful for all of that. I, you know, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I really am to have the job that I have. And I'm just very thankful that this is not a thankful job. Not a thankless job. You know, when I was in Quincy the other day, you know, I stopped at the Stop and Shop over there on Newport Ave and, you know, ended up holding court there in the supermarket. But people are so good. You know, they say thanks for what you do. And that goes a long way. It goes a long way.
Well, we appreciate your time here at QATV. Thank you for chatting with us. And please, if we can do anything to help your effort, give us a call.
Well, thank you, Joe. I really do appreciate your show and Quincy Access Cable, because you bring so many of the local issues that wouldn't get play on a big network, but are you know, dearly important to the people that we represent. So I really appreciate the job that you do as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day, Congressman.
You too, Joe. Stay safe.